cul-de-sac that leads. And that's the cul-de-sac that leads to Bayside Park.
Straight up the.
Thank you for your comment.
House to kind of buffer it a little bit, but it's not high enough, the height and tail of the planes.
The airport director you mentioned was Lou.
It's, you cannot, when, mostly in the afternoon it happens, you can't even sit on the front porch and talk to somebody else. It gets that bad. I should have moved years ago, but I didn't, so I've stayed here. But it is, you're kind of repeating the same thing that's been done for years and years. And somebody has got to get out. I personally, I tried a couple of times what I think the airport should have done instead of do the window program, which was putting everybody in a prison. Because you put the windows in, double windows, none of them work. You can't even get them to work. And, but it has helped the noise in the house.
So is your sense that when they planted those trees, that vegetation was helpful?
Definitely. Maintaining it and a lot, it doesn't stop the noise, but it stops you from seeing the noise.
Okay, well, thank you again. I appreciate your comments. I'm not going to tell you how old I was in 1962, but.
No, I came here in 57, so. I frankly think the airport's made a mistake. They're what their policies is.
Did you?
I suggested a long time ago, and I have a lot of times. What they should have done over the years is each time a home went up for sale, bought it, rented it to their employees, and eliminated that whole problem, at least in the Bayside Manor, Emory, Vista area.
And I think Supervisor Pine had a question.
Did you avail yourself of the insulation program back in the 80s? Did you put the insulation in?
Yeah.
You did.
Oh, it helped inside. You got to keep everything closed. On a hot day, you die. No air conditioning or anything else. And so it did not serve the proper purpose, but the people who put it in, and I don't want to get into that.
Okay, so.
Did a horrible job, and then none of them worked.
So let's finish up the noise barriers. I think we've gotten to the bottom of that issue. And I think we all agree that the noise barriers have limited impact and limited ability, but I am curious to understand the acoustic block and what that could do. But I think clearly we understand that's not going to be what's going to let us sleep at night. So we're going to move on. So with that, I'm going to move on to the discussion of the existing reporting and data. And I'm going to let that go. Justin, you're going to do that one too? Justin, you there?
Sure. Yes. Yep. I'm here.
So you're going
to, I could do that. For item number 3, correct?
4.
Oh.
Oh, you have to.
Sorry. The old agenda, old agenda 3, new agenda 4.
Oh, okay. So I think this is discussion of existing reporting and data. Sorry, you broke up, but.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Okay, so the focus of this item was in what the current permanent noise monitoring system could provide in terms of data. And I know Bert could elaborate more, but the current permanent system, the sites can provide 1 second data for each noise monitoring site that is of interest. And that data could be provided in a historical fashion. And could potentially be used to compare C-weighted values at different points of time of interest. And that time frame could be determined, but just off the top of my head, it could be, yeah.
Line of sight.
Justin, C-weighted is the low frequency noise, correct?
Yes. So yes, thank you. It's instead of A weighted, it's a a weighted metric, which is typically used. C weighting is typically used when you're analyzing low frequency noise. So the data and Bert, correct me if I'm wrong, but the permanent systems can provide various weightings of data, even unweighted, in terms of, you know, 1 second data, if it's requested, right? I mean, you would have to go back and pull that data from your system.
You are correct, although it's limited in some areas due to the fact that the vendor wanted originally for us to pay for it, which we found out after the fact. But yeah, we do have a lot of it for the area surrounding the airport nearby.
I'm sorry, Brett, you said not contractor, the vendor.
Contractor. Okay. Yeah, and so what I would suggest that could be done is potentially looking at 3 periods, maybe 4 periods in time, perhaps, you know, pre-runway end movement, after the runway movement, maybe even a year or two before any of that occurred, to look at the sites nearby to see the sea weighting low frequency noise, to see if it's changed over time based off of the movement. Really get an understanding of that. The duration of the analysis would need to be determined. You know, are you looking at a period of a week in time or a day? Obviously, the more days, the more processing time and analysis. Obviously, you would want to pick more than one day because.
If I may interrupt, Justin.
Sure.
Say 2013, which would be pre-RSA project, 2014, maybe before and after, and then, or even during, because that's a significant too, and then 2018, 2019.
That sounds reasonable to me, and I think it would provide some really interesting information on how the low frequency noise has changed, or if it has changed, what is the quantity level differences. So.
And Justin, what's the useful time frame for each point in time? Is a week?
At least a week.
Yeah, I would say at least a week. Once you get to like a month, you know, you really start to increase the level of effort in terms of just processing the amount of data. But somewhere between 1 to 2 weeks would be sufficient to get a good average. Don't you think, Bert?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Member Schneider.
And I'm sorry, Justin, did you say the times during the day, like 3 or 4 different periods during the day?
Bracket it out. So you could say, based on using California standard of say 7 to 7, 7 to 10, and then 10 to 7.
So the 3 time periods.
Or something else that we decide.
Here's the one problem, and I've been playing in my head with the fact that a lot of this data is averaged. So it's averaged over a year, or it's averaged over the night shift. And from my personal experience, the 3 o'clock hour, the 1 o'clock hour, the midnight hour, if I'm not already asleep, then they come and it's almost a constant barrage of low frequency noise. So I think we lose something in averaging. And, you know, average, once you've made some conclusions, or maybe for easier reporting, averaging works. But if you just look at one arrivals and runway 19 departures, that, because that's averaged over a year, they don't show up at all.
Well, one thing you can do for that is go to events, and look specifically at single events for the week or two. If you get anything longer than that, kind of becomes unwieldy.
Okay, and I don't know, I mean, when we open it up to the public, I just keep playing around with the use of averages. Sometimes they can be misleading.
So if you were looking at single events, you would look at a single event.
Yeah.
Than something in this week.
Well,
bracket those two. So you could say we had so many that were at,
in this week or in this block of hours.
In the period of time. Gotcha. And then you can also start cutting hairs and saying so many per hour on a given day. You can go over the 2 weeks. In the 1 o'clock hour, we had this many. In the 2 o'clock hour, we had this many. And you can bracket it out by noise levels. You can do a lot of different things with it, especially
when you start
plotting it on graphs and things like that.
The last problem is where our current monitors or where the airport's current devices are may not be the areas that are getting impacted by this type of noise. Because, and I keep trying to come up with a descriptive term, Bert, when you explained this to me, that low frequency noise, I don't want to use line of sight. It's not straight off the back of the plane.
Yeah.
So line of sight isn't really the right term we should be using for this type, or maybe some portions of this type of noise. How does that noise go off? And are our monitors in Hillsborough, in Burlingame, in San Bruno, in the right place to, we can't get the historical data, obviously, but if we need to put some new monitors in, we need to know where that sound is currently going.
Typically on departure aircraft with the tail facing you, the aircraft noise comes out in a cone off the rear of the airplane. So it's not straight back of the airplane, it comes out in a V.
Okay, and once it hits any kind of barrier, does it continue in that line or does it
refract out this way? Especially sea-weighted. One thing I usually use when talking to people about sea-weighted noise is home stereos. These days, home stereos have more than one speaker, speakers for stereo. So typically, you're going to have a 3.1 or a 5.1 surround sound or even more. And what they'll do is they will tell you, take the bass cube, which is the largest speaker of the unit, produces the low frequency noise, the rumble, the bumps, and all that. They say, put it in a corner. Because it's non-directional, it typically will surround the room, but the corner gives it the ability to get thrown out. And the highs, the horns, the whistles, things like that, will be ones that you want to point at the listener, because they're very directional. So if you have a couch in front of your TV, let's say, or your listening area, you want to point it right at you. So if you're a single person in the household, you sit in the middle of your couch and you point them right at your head, you will have the best sound. Now, if you have a family and you're trying to cover the whole listening area, it kind of waters it down a little bit, but you generally point at the listening area. But the back to the original, which is the bass cube, it's off in the corner because it's non-directional.
Okay, so back to one of Anne's questions is, do you have a sense of how it bounces off of structures?
Quite well. Sea-weighted noise really goes through things and around and over. So like when we look at noise contours and things like that, we're not looking at on an A-weighted versus a C-weighted contour. Most of you have seen our A-weighted contour. I use the analogy of an upside-down angel. So the head is at Highway 101, the wings go out east and west, with the skirt being out over the bay. Now, with sea-weighted noise, it looks more cloud-like. It's sort of billowy and goes out in more circular shape. And that's just due to the nature of low frequency being non-directional.
That makes me really nervous when I think of all the construction in Millbury. Right next to what it's going to do, where it's going to bounce. It bounce right at my house. So that's what I'm, that when I think about that, I keep thinking about the big projects you guys have going on, and it just makes me really nervous. But I guess we'll have to catch up and build support.
You on the court, on
build
Adrian.
Really, really high. Yeah.
Really, well, the airport
the one is 10 stories, isn't it?
that's actually much farther along this way. Yeah. The ones, what we call site 6 and site 5, are at maximum 7 stories, and the hotel that's right up front is 5 stories, and the affordable housing is 5 stories.
So let me back up a minute. So the purpose of the monitors would be to identify more specifically the greater noise concern areas, figure out where the noise is highest, and determine the level of change.
We're looking to capture good noise measurements. The nice thing about the noise monitors we do have is generally they're effective out to about a mile. The microphones are good at, within that hemisphere for receiving. Now, as far as what area you wish to cover, we do have them to validate our A-weighted noise contour, primarily. But beyond that, we do have others in the community that do back up as far as infill on the other noise requests. Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to get to, there's this belief that noise has gone up to high frequency infill. And I guess, are you trying to turn this, where is the greatest problem within each community? Does it differ within a community?
Linda, did you want to comment on that real quick?
Yeah, I guess I'm going to rephrase, I think, sure. What you're saying, which is, so on the high frequency noise, you know, the reports that are in the packet every time, those are reports that the airport has been generating monthly over all this time, and we have good data, and it's understandable to the public and all of that. But on low frequency noise, the monitors have been picking it up, but it's effectively stored away somewhere, and we've never really analyzed it. So we're looking back at data that exists that we need to define what is useful to us. So yes, to your question about which community, maybe because that's maybe those two monitors, what data came out of those two monitors versus those two. But it's also what points in time are going to tell us something that's useful. So what Bert was suggesting, the 2013?
Yes, first year.
2013 was prior to the runways being moved, because there's been some suggestion that maybe when the runways move, that changed the load, the impact on the community. So maybe you pick 2 weeks prior to the runways moving and 2 weeks after that construction was done in Burlingame at the night of where the noise monitor is, and just look at those 2 weeks compared at 1 a.m. and see if there really was a difference, because I think that validates what people are feeling.
I think this is really important. I mean, when you kind of boil it all down, right? We're trying to, you know, to measure how the situation is, right? And then we have to explain why is it different. And then thirdly, of course, what can we do about it? So far, you know, we have all the constituents who said it's real to change. But to have this data backing that up will make, I think, put us in a better position to advocate to do something.
I don't disagree. I'm just trying to make sure I understand exactly what we're trying to do with these monitors. And what I'm hearing is that we have pretty good records for high frequency, not very good records for low frequency. Is that
Well, no, we have the records.
We have the records, just not the analysis.
Not for
it's
us,
like you know, gazillions of pieces of data, and we're trying to figure out which the couple.
So we ought to get on this, right? So what is the next step in
terms of? Let me back up. But that begs the question: are the monitors that we have the data from, are they the right
So that's maybe the question for the next piece of the discussion.
But for the purpose of we're trying to understand here, we're looking at the change.
Yeah.
So whether they're here or there, we can figure out
correct
what the change was, and then we can try to connect it to an event at the airport, right, which is the runway. So whether they're we can
that.
Separate, but for this purpose, it doesn't really matter. All we're doing is trying to find the change.
Okay, I'm not disagreeing with that.
Yeah, that's,
with one monitor in lower hills world, that change might be quite different than the monitor. And so we don't have records for that.
Well, if I may, one thing that can be done, and Justin, back me up on this, is you can go back and model historically what happened, and then use the noise monitor data to back that up. So when you pull your model results out, you say, okay, I have X, Y, and Z. Do I have the similar X, Y, and Z out of the actuals? And at that point, you should be able to say, okay, we're comfortable with the data that we have. Or no, we don't like the locations.
So then my second point, I would,
yes,
one said, I really think it's critical to get to the specific. My concern is not the average noise, it's the high noise, or the dominant noise.
I think that's a really good point. The wavelength noise.
Well, I don't let you get to, so can I just add to that? So I'm trying to think. So there's a monitor in Hillsborough, there's two in Burlington, there's two in Milbrae, so I don't remember how many in San Bruno. So given where they are, you might be able to go back and say this cloud of noise would go out like this. The missing piece then is the valleys and the hills. And if there's any concentration in there, that's where we're different than that line of sight on that. And again, we're now looking much more three-dimensionally. And remember, when I first came on the round table, there was that lovely new report that did a three-dimensional noise diagram. Remember, it was a moving video, and you showed, well, maybe it was more airplanes taking off, but you showed them in three-dimensional space.
Noise pile.
Okay. And to me, this is a three-dimensional space that we have to look at with the existing topography, because it may concentrate, for example, in your canyon or the canyons of Hillsborough or the canyons of San Bruno. I will tell you what I've started to do with my community is to ask people where they're feeling the rumble, and I will go out and sit, maybe not at 1 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning, but I need a better sense of topography too. I know that it's concentrating here. We've all heard it at the round table. You know that it's hitting here at City Hall.
You know, you bring up a really good point, and I think that this is the movement of the runways may have not increased the overall noise, but it just kind of redirected it to new places that people are starting to feel it, and those are the people complaining about it. The other people who all of a sudden don't have as much noise, they didn't say anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But the funny thing is, my sense is that the way the noise is moving, when you move those runways back or when you do this or when you build this, it changes. And that's why there's a perception for certain people that there's more noise. Then if you look at the monitors, they're going to say, no, it's about the same.
Yeah.
But it bounced to these people, it's a lot worse because it bounced in that area because of what happened. It's funny you said that, because as you were saying that, I'm kind of getting a visual on the runways being pushed back. It's like, no, that didn't increase the overall noise. It just redirected it.
Well, and it might have made the strength closer.
Yeah, but maybe.
But so there's the because after analysis isn't good necessarily.
Well, and I think Anne brings up a really, really good point. It might not give us that because the overall noise might be the same. But the valleys and the peaks that you're talking about, the topography, that's where it changes, and that's going to be really hard to capture. I think it's worth going to the
exercise. It makes for a really great science project for some PhD candidates. I mean, honestly, this has all the nice makings. The difference with the low-frequency noise is there is the vibration, though, too, and where that vibration is going to, and mitigation for vibration might be different than mitigation for the noise, although I experience in the same way. I feel them in my eardrum, especially those 1 to 3 o'clock in the morning flights. So back to what time periods we're going to look at. I assume that we're going to look at maybe a summertime with windows open and a time when windows might be closed. Also, because those two situations mean that the atmospheric conditions are going to be different. So if you go a summer, you've got atmospheric really conditions, and then a winter or a fall. And peak flying time, is that July? Is that the busiest month of the year or September?
July,
you know, are we
going to
look at the busiest time versus the most busy time?
Can
we pick peak times?
Can I jump in?
Go ahead, Justin.
Is this specifically for the sea weighting comparison?
Yes.
Is the time frame?
Yes,
we're discussing.
We're talking about the low.
Okay, I mean, yes, and in terms of that comparison, I understand like looking at a particular time frame, but I want to just mention that not necessarily does it need to be the peak season, only because what we're really wanting to find out is, like Ricardo said, the delta change. And if you break it down on a single event basis, which to get a better understanding, you may, in a peak situation, you know, you're trying to also isolate events, right? And that's one of those complexities that we knew we'd run into is how do you know what is coming from where and what event is causing what? So I would just caution that it doesn't necessarily have to be the peak season because we're looking at the delta change. And if we want to hone down on a specific event or a specific, you know, whatever source it is, to do that, actually looking at periods like at the night would be really great because the frequency is less, you know, less. So you could really dive down if that makes sense. I just want to make sure to say that because it is helpful when you're looking at data if you actually know what source you're looking at and you don't have a multitude of sources going on it necessarily at one time. That is also helpful, but if we want to break it down, looking at periods of nighttime, for instance, would be really beneficial.
Talking about having without the cacophony and the blending of noise, more pure.
Sound. Yes, correct.
And to be honest, and I, again, to use me as an example, during the day, there are the other noises, but at night, and that is when it keeps me awake. It could be, I'm only concerned. You know, it's funny, and you guys know your airport operations. Sunday morning, Sunday night are horrible time periods, starting at 5 o'clock in the morning and Sunday night. Saturday night sometimes is quieter. There's certain nights during the week, which must have to do with the flights going out.
And
that's the annoyance.
That's great information. Yeah.
Subjective kind of information. But if and we're not at the point of trying to go to solutions, and I'm sorry, my personality
you know what,
to go to solutions.
I want to keep moving.
Keep that in mind, the days of the week.
Running out of time.
But and I just want to quickly say those are great points. I think those time frames of annoyance would be really great to focus in on the analysis. So I think those are the time frames. If we could get feedback like that, it would help us look at, you know, in detail those specific times. Which
okay, so let me again, I want to try to move on so that we can get to the next steps, but I do have a speaker. You have a point you want to make?
I just wanted to suggest one additional purpose that I'd like to draw from the data, and that is, and I don't know, Bert and Justin, you'd have to tell us if it's feasible, is to optimize takeoff dual side-by takeoffs or near side-by takeoffs.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Because I think that there's going to be a lot of louder noise events with the near simultaneous and the interaction of the two.
And how often, how common do two airplanes, one on one R, one on R?
Fairly common.
Fairly common.
I'd like to complicate it further, Kathleen.
Oh, thank you, Bert.
a arriving flight with the reverse thrust followed immediately by a departure.
It could be. Mm-hmm. Not the directionality as much with the correct reverse thrust. Not to say it's not a good idea, but when you got the two side-bys.
45-degree cone, as that aircraft hits the reverse thrust, comes by, it's going to overlap.
Okay. We're going to analyze this. We're going to understand that it's not going to be perfect. We're going to try to try to separate it as much from everything so that we can kind of come up with something we understand, because again, I think that's going to be a really difficult one to parse out.
Of being able to determine the effect of the dual or near dual takeoff, side by takeoffs, is the fact that if that's a big factor, my secret guess is that it's a significant, that might be something you would advocate for nighttime not doing. So I think that's why it's important to determine if that makes a big difference.
That's a good point. And my guess is with increasing volumes, that is more common to have the two at the same time.
Well, with the operations of the airport, you've heard many times, the runways are only 750 feet apart, centerline to centerline. So the most efficient way that airport operates is to have departures go on the ones and arrivals come on the 28s, and they go alternate. And that's the way the airport operates efficiently. So the way the tower does it is they load both runways, pop them off, bring two in the same time.
So it's actually really
if
common.
They can do it.
Can I just add an aside? I was just reading how nature tells us of warnings and read a study on wave actions where you actually have waves coming at each other perpendicular and how dangerous that is for ships and swimmers. So it's,
that's exactly.
And it shows this photograph and it's pretty amazing. I've never seen it before, but
okay, so warnings. So let me just to try to wrap this one up. I think Justin has, and I think we have a lot of different things to take into consideration when we're analyzing the data. Justin, are you good to move forward?
Yes, I mean, I think we have enough information to refine what we, you know, how to best move forward.
Sorry, one member of the public who has expressed interest in speaking on this item, go ahead, please.
Yes.
And what is your name, please?
So the few things that I saw, I know staff had the KMZ files with the Google Earth, and that showed the elevation. If staff can make the KMZ files available on the roundtable, because Google Earth Pro is a free tool to download from the public's perspective, and we can actually manipulate the KMZ files ourselves, meaning us as the public, so we can look at the elevation and the whole data set and all that. So the KMZ files that the staff showed at the previous roundtable meeting, if you can make those KMZ files available, you guys had the Google Earth Pro open up and you had the KMZ file with the plane going up the model.
That was the FAA's
right.
Departure data for the port.
Right, if they can make that KMZ file available so we can download that ourselves.
Okay, but that was more connected to it already in flight, that's less of the ground-based noise issue, correct? Is that what you...
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay.
And then in terms of establishing some kind of a data release schedule, because I know sometimes a lot of the things are agenda items, you know, we have to look at data, you know, in terms of looking at the data. So if we could establish a data release schedule, perhaps on the website itself, so we as the public, rather than just going to each individual agenda item and agenda packet, we can just go to, let's see what the quarterly report was, or data in terms of.
Well, okay, so we have the data for, that's not the, not the C-weighted data is already put out in a certain schedule. I mean, that we don't have to change, correct?
Director's reports are monthly.
Got it.
And the report is quarterly.
Okay.
So just to add to that.
So my answer to that is, this, what we're talking about here is the C data that's related to ground-based noise that has to do with, that's a completely new concept, but it's new for this body. So that's going to be hard for us to put into a schedule. We really good.
I don't imagine. Rather for the future, for the upcoming year. So just having that. And then I'm assuming that the noise is the same vendor as previously.
The new vendor is the same as we had before.
No, my question is, are they, after 1 year of installation, are they themselves going to do a study and comparison of the new of the data from the new sensors and compare it to the data from the old sensors? Are they themselves?
We have to certify for the state of California the new system. So once the new monitors are all installed, they will go ahead and ensure that each one's calibrated and set like it should be. Design a report up that we will validate. We're also going to give a copy to our consultant. We'd be happy to provide a copy of the roundtable as well, so that they can all see, yes, we agree that that's been done for Title 21 standards.
Well, the, I guess what I'm saying is a year from now, will there be a comparison of the data from the old data sets with the old sensors compared to the new data sets? And then
can.
And just to see what the variances are. And then I understand that there was the argument that data or not data sensor locations are not available to the public, if my understanding is correct.
Mm-hmm.
The data sensors
are not the location of the monitors.
The specific location, no, some of them are
private. Right, so the ones that are on private property, there would be that argument. But what about those that are not on private property, say public property?
I can ask our attorneys. Last recollection I had was they said just don't publicly publish location.
So exact location. Okay, yeah. So that's
the basic location.
Yeah.
Right. So then I guess my response to that would be don't publish the exact location, but something that gives the public the general idea of where it is.
We do.
That's actually available right now if you go to our 3D flight tracker on the web. So all you have to do is just zoom in on the area you're looking at, and it shows noise monitors that are active. And you can see generally where that is.
Do you know the variance of the
You know what? I'm going to have to let you talk about that offline.
Specifically, no, I don't.
That is not specific. So let me just move on, and you could reach out to Bert and get that information. So I want to move on to...
I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Lynn. So I'm sorry, but I do have a hard stop at noon, and I just have to get this. So next steps, are there any gaps in the research? Who was going to talk about is that?
That was, I think that was me too. But, yep. All right. So I would say that the research talks extensively over a number of different possible mitigation options. Obviously, they talk about typical sound insulation techniques that you would find in that program, such as upgraded windows and doors. And they go further in talking about added mitigation measures that were actually tried out even in the SFO area, of double stud walls, increasing mass of the walls, increasing window thickness, and things of that nature that would further reduce low frequency noise. They go into detail about the whether that actually worked or not. They talk a lot about rattling and vibration and possible mitigation measures there. I would say that the gaps are really in any ongoing or recent research of products such as the we talked about earlier that would go in the wall that reduce low frequency noise from the university. Or possible noise cancellation research. In the last meeting, I mentioned that HMH submitted a research idea to Airport Cooperative Research Program, which is funded by the FAA to look at noise cancellation further. It was done quite a while ago, but there's new technology and some potential reductions that would, I think, deserve to be looked at again as a possible solution. And we talked in the last meeting about kind of what noise cancellation does. Those types of things, I think, are where the gaps are. The gaps are on just recent research within, I would say, the last year or so, that really looks into low frequency noise. The other things that they talked about, quite frankly, haven't changed all that much over time. There has been developments into better STC windows, and STC is sound transmission class. It's a rating given to windows on their performance of reducing noise. And while you might have an STC window that says 40, each different one might reduce low frequency noise different. So you could have a same number window rated as a 40, but one might reduce low frequency better than another. So there has been advancements in that kind of technology that potentially could be looked at. But you know, the typical noise sound insulation measures really haven't all changed that much. You know, you focus in on the windows and doors, making sure they're sealed properly. Those are the weakest point of the structure. And then beyond that, once you have that, the weakest part usually is the wall. And to really reduce low frequency noise on a wall, you have to add substantial mass, or you have to alternate between masses. So, you know, air gap, studs, insulation, you know, drywall. Thank you.
I'm going to add two things to perhaps gaps in research. Everything you mentioned is remediation. It's after the fact. Mm-hmm. And noise is a pollutant. And pollutants mean it's a resource not being used well. So change in engine design, just along the lines of going from a stage 3 to a stage 4, stage 5 engine, I think we need to be pushing back with the manufacturers to be looking at new engine design. And then I'm going to call it the three T's, terminal taxi and takeoff procedures, that maybe there are some changes in procedures that could help with this. I had spoken to the person who used to represent Millbrae, and I'm really bad with names today. And I had thought that if we did a steep takeoff, that it might be better. And he said, Ann, you better be careful what you ask for, because if you taxi and or run up, I don't know the right term, you're taking off, and then you do a steep, it might actually cause the sound to bounce like up over in an arch, as opposed to, I don't know. See, I don't know. So there's like, oh, I was all ready to have those steep takeoffs way at the end of the runway, but maybe that's part of the problem.
If I may break that down into a colloquial I use on our phone call, think of a person at a stoplight. If they accelerate off the stoplight nice and even, you better hear it. Now, if you have the kid in the hot rod that sits there and lays on the gas, you're going to hear the squealing tires and everything else and the engine revving and everything, boom. So there's a lot of noise initially, and then boom, they get off and going. That is good for communities off of runway 28. There are fish out there off the one, so we're thinking we may not need to use the high power initially, just more of a gradual takeoff.
So the data to me that's missing is which of our airlines and which of our pilots are doing one over another.
Well, United has said they're doing it on all runways. They're all airports.
Hold on. So what we're talking about,
gaps in data.
I know, so the gap, but this is a very important one, yeah. Because I agree that those procedures could have some significant impact. So this came out of, we were talking about a noise NDAP, a noise
NADP,
noise abatement departure procedure, which was basically something where the airplane goes up high, steeper, and then hits the engines way up higher, correct?
That's
right. So what the question for us was, when you do that, are you creating more ground-based noise, more of the low-frequency noise? Kathleen, you seem like you need something to say.
I do have something to say. Thank you. The two different types of takeoffs that we're referring to, NADP1 and NADP2. Okay, noise abatement, departure procedure 1 and 2, are not based on takeoff thrust or engine power setting, demo 1. So there's no difference between them on the power setting, right? That's a different factor, which may or may not be a factor, but it's not part of this NADP1 versus 2. And
correct.
Justin, help me understand, there's supposedly a double, sort of a double bounce on noise from ground-based noise with engine power and then with rotation and bouncing off the runway. At what point does that second bouncing off the runway factor ease off? Do you know what altitude they're at?
Yeah.
What altitude are they
yeah,
at?
Yeah, it's really...
Longer factor.
It would be really close in when they change angles to write off a liftoff. That's where you hit you would hear the second peak potentially of noise as it bounces off the runway. That would be potentially the only thing. I happened to see United yesterday. Glenn from United, and I brought this up actually just because I knew we would be potentially talking about this, and he seems to think that whether it's NADP1 or NADP2, that thrust, that liftoff point, and the angle at that point right off the runway would not change between the NADPs. It's only further out would you see a potential change, and at that point it's airborne noise. It's not necessarily anything that would be ground based. Yeah.
So the reason for that is that NADP1 and 2 are identical in process until the airplane is 800 feet in the air.
Identical. Okay, but NADP1 tells me that it's different than what we were doing before.
So what happens? No, it's was it's for ground-based noise, it's a non-issue.
No, okay, so.
But for, I can talk to you about what difference it makes once it's airborne. But let's talk about ground-based. And that for, so the airplane uses the same power setting, the same procedure as it rolls down the runway, the same procedure as it rotates the nose gear, the same procedure as it lifts off. All of that is identical, one versus two.
Mm-hmm. But I'm sorry, but can I just give a clarification? You're talking about NADP, with whether it's one or two, what is the option that's no NADP? So
that's it.
That's the only two options. I'm sorry.
Good question. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I guess you could have an airline that wants to freeform their own kind of departure. And there are some variations. Let me just finish this part. And then I can tell you about that. But so the generally the two primary choices are one or two. Mm-hmm. Takeoff thrust, takeoff roll, takeoff rotation. Getting nose wheel up, getting the main gears off. And that's where Justin was just talking about. The thrust from the engines are now pointed down more at the runway and it gives you a different bounce. At that point, they put the gear up, they continue to climb out till they get to 800 feet above the ground, above ground level. Well, actually it's MSL in this case, because it's zero. At that point, at 800 feet, NADP1 just continues to climb out. Doesn't do much change, just continues to climb out, climbs out to
800 feet. It's not ground-based noise anymore.
My point, exactly. And NADP2 at 800 feet, slowly lowers a little bit, still is climbing, but not as fast, and now is taking some of that extra thrust and turning it into airspeed. So now at 800 feet, this guy is slowly accelerating while climbing, and then is able to raise the flaps up because at a faster airspeed, you don't need as much flaps, and then raises them up some more. And so that by, 1,000 to 1,100 feet, they are now a clean configuration. They don't have flaps.
Okay, so for our purposes, the difference between NADP1 or 2, as far as the initial thrust, as far as the secondary noise when it's airborne, you're saying there is no difference.
There is no difference until 800 feet above.
So if we said that one of the gaps in our study is the procedures, you would tell me no, those are the same.
They are the same. Now I'll tell you there are a couple of other variables. You have the pilot has a choice between a reduced power takeoff and a maximum power takeoff. I would say something in the high 90% are all reduced power takeoffs.
I'm a pilot, I'm sitting on the highway one ready to go, they give me the green light, and I'm just picturing they just shove that thing all the way down and take off and wake me up.
Well, the difference is that before you take off, you calculate the amount of power you need to safely meet all the criteria to take off.
Based on the weight.
Based on the weight, the wind, all sorts of things. But it's the pilots and the dispatchers. And
let me ask a question, because I think that's so important. Because one of the things that we were always told is the volumes have increased, but the actual operations haven't. Which means the planes are going loaded a lot heavier than they have.
We've admitted that. So when
we talk about that initial thrust, because those planes are loaded up heavier, that initial thrust is heavier than it used to be.
Yes, although your engines are being developed as they go on to be quieter at higher power settings. So, there's a combination of factors.
But they're designed to be quieter. In-flight noise, level noise, not sea level noise.
We don't know.
Because we don't measure sea level.
Do we know that, Justin?
We don't complain about sea level.
Justin, do we know that? That the new generation...
Can you read?
So the question is,
rephrase.
New generation engines take into consideration sea-weighted versus A-weighted?
Actually, when the airline or the manufacturers certify, it's a completely different metric that they go to. They don't look at A weighting or C weighting. It's something completely different called EPNL. But it's independent. It's just aircraft based. It's a standard that they have to comply with for certifying if it's a stage 3, 4, or 5 or whatnot.
Okay, I'm really sorry, but I really do have to get back to work. So the gaps, I think we're going to have to come back to that. But that was very helpful, Kathleen. Thank you so much for that. That was very helpful. As far as the way we're able to address these gaps, I think we need some more information. So we're probably going to have to table that one. And as far as subcommittee recommendation, I think we're going to have to table that one and come up with, there's a few items that we need some more information on before we can make a recommendation to the full roundtable. Are we all in agreement? I see some nodding for the record.
I had a quick question for Justin. Yes. On the historic, data, e-weighted data, how long would it take you to kind of look at that? I mean, that's just the process of kind of analyzing what we already have, right?
Yeah, it depends on the time frame and then the detail of, are we going down to an hourly basis? Are we looking at some single events, or are we doing that? Are we just spot checking certain areas of concern? So depending on that, the data crunching could be relatively quick, but then diving down into looking at specifics could take some time. We're talking maybe a couple of weeks, not anything.
Okay, so just for everybody, we have another committee meeting in September, correct? So we'll work with analysis. We're not ready. We may just delay the meeting so that when next time we have some things to talk about. Not today, obviously, but I think we actually got a lot done today, and I appreciate Kathleen your input. That was very helpful. And with that, if nobody has anything, we would ready to adjourn. Go ahead, Anne.
Just a quick announcement in terms of what you spoke about. The City of Millbrae has prepared a rather lengthy document on what should go into the environmental study with the airport expansion. And I have my own set of notes that I sent to them, which was mainly noise, but they'll have other things in it. If you would like, I'm happy to share and to share that. The deadline for the comments to go into the environmental research has been extended to July 10th. My understanding is from our meeting last night, July 10th, but I'll verify that before the deadline was last Friday or the Friday before. I know it was kind of a rush job for us to get our act together.
Okay, well, again, thank you all for being here. That was actually very educational today.
It was a good meeting. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks, Justin.
No problem. Bye.
I am so.